topic in greater depth, I can strongly recommend Professor William Cook's 24-lecture series, The Cathedral, which includes several sites that will enrich any trip to England. But let me reiterate the point I made earlier. The cathedrals are fascinating, but you shouldn't feel the obligation to visit them all. When you do enter one, look for interesting curiosities from the different centuries, as well as marvelling at the great designs the buildings embody, which still today have so much power to impress.
Lecture 7, Tudor Britain.
King Richard III died at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485, defeated by Henry Tudor. This was the last battle in the Wars of the Roses. For more than half a century, the Lancastrians and the Yorkists, all descended from Edward III, had exchanged blows in their struggle for the throne. Henry Tudor, now crowned as Henry VII, was a shrewd, tight-fisted king from the Lancastrian side. He pacified England, married a Yorkist princess, made a clever dynastic alliance with the King of Spain, and, at his death in 1509, passed the kingdom to his talented, handsome, and warlike son, Henry VIII. Bosworth Field in Leicestershire, the site of his victory, is largely farmland today. But a visitor centre, a museum, and a set of footpaths enable you to walk over the ground where the soldiers fought and died. There's a historian's controversy over whether you're on quite the right place. One group continues to claim that it's wrong by about 2 miles. Never mind, the exhibits give you a lively sense of the participants, the immense class gulf that separated knights from men-at-arms, and the way the armies had moved to their rendezvous over the preceding weeks. Henry, with an army from France, had landed in southwest Wales at Mill Bay in Pembrokeshire, near his birthplace, then marched slowly east and north, picking up recruits along the way. One of the keys to the battle was the arrival at Bosworth of Thomas Stanley, a nobleman with his own private army. Stanley watched to see which side appeared to be winning, then intervened on Henry's side. The loser of the Battle of Bosworth Field, Richard III, had been King of England for only 2 years. Most people know Richard through Shakespeare, who depicts him as a malicious hunchback who did evil for its own sake. There's always been an offsetting pro-Richard faction, whose views are well expressed in Josephine Tay's 1951 novel, The Daughter of Time. Its hero, a detective stuck in hospital with a broken leg, goes over all the evidence to conclude that Richard was a good and blameless man, scapegoated by Tudor propaganda, and that the actual villain was Henry VII. Everyone with a dog in this fight was fascinated to learn, in 2012, that the body of a hunchback man had been discovered beneath a parking lot where Greyfriars Church had once stood in the city of Leicester. DNA testing proved that it was in fact Richard, and that at least one part of the Shakespearean version was true. Analysis of the remains showed that severe blows to the head had killed him, after which his body had been apparently stabbed and hacked. A squabble then broke out over whether, as a king, he should be buried at Westminster Abbey, or perhaps as a Yorkist, at York. The mayor of Leicester, recognising the publicity benefits for his city, declared, "These bones leave Leicester over my dead body." In the end, he got his way. A reinterment ceremony took place at Leicester Cathedral, with the Archbishop of Canterbury officiating, but with members of other Christian denominations in attendance. Sure enough, his grave has become a tourist attraction. Henry VIII became king in 1509 at the age of 18. His older brother, Prince Arthur, had died prematurely in 1502. Henry married his brother's widow, Catherine of Aragon, just after ascending the throne, and remained married to her until he was 40. Her inability to give him a surviving male heir sparked the political and religious crisis that ended with his marriage to Anne Boleyn and the English Reformation. The story of his six wives is one of the most famous in English history. Almost equally well known is the story of Henry's ministers, Cardinal Wolsey, Thomas More, and Thomas Cromwell, whose fortunes rose and fell with Henry's marriage gambits. For a taste of royal opulence in Henry's reign, visit Hampton Court Palace in southwest London. It was designed and built by Cardinal Wolsey, a worldly churchman who was Henry's chief advisor in the 1510s and 20s. He aimed to show foreign ambassadors and papal envoys that, as a cardinal, he enjoyed the same high style as the cardinals in Rome itself, and that he had impeccable taste. Italian workmen accomplished much of the detailed work. Hampton bears witness to the truth that red brick can be just as impressive as stone when it comes to building monumental houses. It has a series of superb gatehouses, handsome quadrangles, and a wonderful astronomical clock. The Great Hall, added by Henry VIII in the 1530s, has a marvellous hammer beam roof and is vast. The kitchens, greatly extended by Henry, who seized the house after Wolsey's fall from grace, often had to feed 1,000 people per day. Hampton was extended by Christopher Wren in the 1690s for King William III, so that the facade facing the gardens looks very different from the Tudor front. William and his queen, Mary II, spent much of their time at Hampton Court. The painting gallery and the great murals around one of the staircases date from their era. The gardens facing Wren's Baroque facade are a mixture of formal and informal designs. And there's a famous maze made up of hedges that's surprisingly challenging. When I visited Hampton Court as a 10-year-old, this was the highlight of the whole visit. Returning at the age of 60, I found it far less labyrinthine than memory had made it, but still a good challenge. In 1534, Henry VIII declared himself head of the English Church, separating English religious life from Rome and the popes. He then abolished shrines to the saints throughout England, closed the monasteries, appropriated all their property to himself, and put a stop to pilgrimages. These actions had the effect of making him wealthier than any previous English king, and also potentially more powerful, because there was no longer any question of sharing spiritual and temporal power. All power was now concentrated in himself. By distributing lands seized from the church to his loyal followers, Henry created a class of retainers with an immediate personal debt of gratitude to himself. From our vantage point, it's difficult to recall just how widespread and how powerful the English monasteries had become. There are more than 800 ruined abbeys, priories, and monasteries across Britain. Many are imposing, even as ruins. At Revo Abbey in Yorkshire, for example, enough of the complex remains to give you a vivid sense of its extent and magnificence. Aelred, abbot from 1147 to 1167, was determined to make the place spectacular. There were in all 72 buildings, serving 140 monks and 500 lay brothers at the height of its prosperity. The ruined sanctuary of their church shows it to have been a place comparable to the great cathedrals. Founded by the Cistercians in 1132, Revo was meant to be a place dedicated to asceticism and mortification, remote from the temptations of the world. But the passage of time led to a gradual relaxation of the rules. The monks bred sheep for wool and mined for lead and iron. When Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, he dispersed the remaining 23 monks and handed the whole estate over to Thomas Manners, the Earl of Rutland. A later owner, Thomas Duncombe, recognised the scenic possibilities of the site. In 1758, he built a terrace overlooking the picturesque Revo ruins. It's a curving, high-level path, marked at its north and south ends by classical temples. By then, the fact of the abbey being a ruin was one of its chief attractions, making it a point of special interest rather than a mere remnant of old Catholic England. Fountains Abbey, nearby, a comparable ruin, was similarly valued for its decrepitude. Among other picturesque monasteries dissolved by Henry is Tintern Abbey on the Welsh side of the River Wye. Founded in the 1100s and also growing to cathedral dimensions in the late 13th century, it too was Cistercian, though its remains don't bring to mind poverty, chastity and obedience, so much as drama and ostentation. Henry VIII dismissed the abbot at Tintern and gave the site to a courtier in 1536, after which it too gradually decayed. In the late 1700s, however, it became the centrepiece of a vogue for paintings and rambles in wild settings. In another lecture, I'll say more about the poet Wordsworth, who wrote one of his best-known poems about a reverie beside Tintern Abbey. And in still another lecture, we'll meet the artist William Gilpin, who popularised the concept of the picturesque and named Tintern in its wooded valley as the perfect example. On Henry VIII's death in 1547, 9-year-old Edward VI, the son of Jane Seymour, came to the throne. He lasted only 6 years, during which the kingdom faced the distressing and unfamiliar fact that a queen rather than a king was likely to be his successor. This wasn't simply a question of gender bias. Kings were supposed to be warrior leaders, and the inability of queens to lead armies, along with the expectation that they would be dominated by whomever they married, led to fears of intrigue and political instability. That was a serious matter to Britons who could clearly remember the Wars of the Roses. The 15-year-old Edward VI, recognising that his death was near, nominated his cousin, 15-year-old Lady Jane Grey, to succeed him because she was a Protestant. Her reign lasted only a week before the 37-year-old Mary Tudor, Henry VIII's oldest daughter, marched on London from Framlingham in Suffolk with her sister Elizabeth and a large military contingent to displace her. The intelligent and well-educated Jane Grey was imprisoned, later tried for treason, and ultimately beheaded at the Tower of London. Mary became Queen Mary I, often known to posterity as Bloody Mary. The new queen had a strong claim to the throne. She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife. But her accession was bound to cause trouble because she was an outspoken Catholic. Her plan to marry Philip II of Spain made the situation worse, as it threatened to yoke England to Spain, then the world's strongest power, and to the papacy. Parliament specified that English soldiers would not have to fight in Spanish wars, and that no Spaniards could be appointed to English offices. Philip landed on the south coast of England in July 1554 and married Mary 2 days later at Winchester Cathedral. Mary persecuted and killed several of England's Protestant leaders, including 3 bishops, Cranmer, Latimer and Ridley, who were burned at the stake in Oxford. Their willingness to die for their faith demonstrated that there was more than cold political calculation involved in the English Reformation. The Martyrs' Memorial in Oxford that commemorates them is Victorian, from about 1840, but its design is strongly reminiscent of the Eleanor Crosses that Edward I had set up in England to commemorate his wife in the 1290s. Mary's persecution of Protestants explains her unpopularity. One Protestant who fled from England to save his life, John Fox, later wrote a book about the whole episode. Fox's Acts and Monuments, popularly known as Fox's Book of Martyrs, became a Protestant classic, widely read in England and America right into the late 1800s, depicting Mary as a monster and the Protestants as Christ-like in their willingness to die for their faith. The first edition, lavishly illustrated with woodcuts, was one of the biggest publication projects in English history up to that date, and later editions expanded on the first, making it the equivalent of one of today's blockbuster book releases. Mary's death in 1558, at the age of 42, made way for her younger half-sister, Elizabeth I, daughter of Anne Boleyn. Elizabeth took the throne, reigned for 45 years, persecuted Catholics, where Mary had persecuted Protestants, carefully avoided marriage, and became a legend in her own lifetime. Among the Catholics who suffered at Elizabeth's hands was Mary Stuart, Queen of Scotland, whom she imprisoned for 18 years and finally executed in 1587. Today you can visit many of the places where Mary, Queen of Scots, was imprisoned, including Carlisle Castle near Hadrian's Wall and Bolton Castle in Yorkshire. Little remains of Fotheringay Castle, where Mary was put to death, but the site is marked by a bit of masonry from the castle's keep, along with some commemorative markers. One Catholic response to Elizabethan persecution was the priest hole. Families still loyal to the old Catholic faith knew that their priests were in danger for their lives. So, at several country houses, secret rooms were built where the priest could hide when the pursuivants, or priest hunters, came searching. An excellent example is Harvington Hall in Worcestershire, where you can peer into a series of priest holes, 7 in all, including an attic hide that is accessed via a false fireplace. Some of the hiding places at Harvington were designed and built by the Jesuit lay brother Nicholas Owen, who kept busy at this task for nearly 30 years before being captured and tortured to death in 1606. Priest holes aside, the design of English houses changed radically between 1485 and 1603. Henry VIII's abolition of private armies and the end of the Wars of the Roses created a situation in which fortification was no longer necessary. The best Tudor houses in England have much bigger windows than the old castles, and they conspicuously do not have curtain walls, moats, drawbridges, and portcullises. Some of them might still be called castles, but really, they're mansions, more comfortable, lighter, and less communal than their predecessors. The craze for building bigger and better houses was a status contest, much commented on at the time. In 1577, an Essex clergyman wrote, "Every man almost is a builder, and he that hath bought any small parcel of ground, be it never so little, will not be quiet till he have pulled down the old house, if any were there standing, and set up a new after his own device." By our standards, the work was agonizingly slow because there were no machines to expedite the process, and even getting the materials to the site could take years. One fine example of the new Tudor house is Woolerton Hall in Nottingham, designed in the 1580s by Robert Smithson and owned by Sir Francis Willoughby. Willoughby had made a fortune in coal mining and hoped to entice the Queen to visit him by creating a spectacular setting that she would enjoy. A royal visit was ruinously expensive, but it did wonders for a man's prestige at court. Woolerton is one of several houses from the era that architectural historians refer to as prodigy houses because of their showiness. The exterior is busy with decoration, turrets, and towers. The most impressive interior room is the Great Hall, 3 stories high. When I visited, it was hosting an exhibition of Chinese dinosaur skeletons, and this central room was big enough for a full-sized brontosaurus. The house, standing on a hilltop, dominates the surrounding parkland in striking contrast to the suburban landscape beyond the gates. It's slightly disappointing to learn that Elizabeth never actually visited Woolerton, confining herself throughout her reign to places in the south of England. A prodigy house that the Queen did visit is Longleat, now famous as the site of a safari park, where it's possible to watch lions and giraffes wandering about the grounds. Another fine example of the Tudor country house is Hardwick Hall in Derbyshire, which might also have been designed by the Woolerton architect, Smithson. Built on a hilltop, close to the ruins of an earlier hall, it belonged to Bess of Hardwick, a larger-than-life red-headed businesswoman who somehow managed to outlive four husbands, three of them rich, each of whom bequeathed to her another fortune. Last of the four was the Earl of Shrewsbury, one of the richest and most politically important men in the kingdom. Their marriage was stormy, and they eventually separated, each with a vast fortune. She began to build the big house at Hardwick when she was already 63. Just 100 yards from the old hall, which is now a ruin, but was then inhabited by most of her retinue. The new hall's immense facade, dominated by expanses of window, was unprecedented. Glass was a luxury item. But she could afford it, having invested shrewdly in the glass and lead businesses that were developing in the area. Visit Hardwick if you possibly can. It has some of the grandest staircases in the kingdom. There's just one fly in the ointment. Bess ordered a set of tapestries from the best Flemish workshops to decorate the high great chamber, the big public room on the top floor of the house. By all accounts, they were brilliantly colourful and superbly well made. The National Trust, which now owns the house, has decided to leave nearly all of them hanging where she put them. 4 centuries of deterioration from light, from damp, from insects, and from sheer age have transformed them into dull, lifeless, deeply unattractive objects. I'm one of many visitors to have pleaded with the National Trust to get rid of them and to put in their place replicas of the same brightness as the originals were when new. Only by doing so can we get a sense of what the house felt like when she lived there. It might be a good idea to leave just one of the threadbare old tapestries for the sake of comparison. But to have the whole lot on display is madness, replacing what should be an exuberant scene with a feeling of fusty dullness. Bess herself would certainly not have put up with it. Melford Hall in Suffolk is a striking example of a Tudor house built on formerly monastic lands. In fact, its cellars were part of the monastery, and the current house was built right on top of them. It's a red brick structure with 6 impressive towers, topped by onion-shaped domes. They're echoed in its imposing gatehouse. Queen Elizabeth I visited in 1578 as a sign of favour to the Cordell family, the owners and builders. She is memorialised in a fine stained glass window. The house was smashed and looted during the Civil War of the 1640s, but then rebuilt. It was bought in the 1780s by the Hyde Parker family, the most famous member of which, Admiral Sir Hyde Parker, was Horatio Nelson's commander at the Battle of Copenhagen in 1801. It was he who signalled Nelson to disengage, an order that Nelson ignored. Legend has it that Nelson lifted the telescope to his blind eye in order not to be able to see the flag signal, then went on to win a smashing victory. A portrait of Admiral Hyde Parker has pride of place in one of the early 19th century editions. Melford House was partially redesigned in almost every generation. A grand staircase seems out of place ascending from the 16th century Great Hall, though it's a fine thing in itself, with classical pillars on each side as it rises. The gardens are mainly Edwardian from the early 20th century, and there's a ha-ha in good condition. A ha-ha is a walled ditch surrounding the house. It prevents farm animals from coming into the gardens, but has the added advantage of being invisible from the house, so that the family, as they gaze through their windows, have an unimpeded view into the distance. Beatrix Potter was a friend of the family and often went to stay in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Her bedroom is preserved, and an exhibit in the superb garden house includes many of the drawings she made at Melford. Ironically, she and Jemima Puddle Duck are almost certainly better known today than the Admiral. Just over a mile from Melford stands Kentwell, another fine house from the same era, built in the same style. The parish church of Long Melford, Holy Trinity, lies between the two houses, and it's among the most spectacular churches in the whole kingdom. built by prosperous wool merchants in the Perpendicular style just before the Reformation. Holy Trinity could easily pass as a cathedral. Simon Jenkins, author of England's 1,000 Best Churches, includes it in his top 20 for the whole country. Three wonderful buildings within a short walk of each other make this part of Suffolk particularly engaging. Some late 16th and early 17th century builders created puns or lessons in stone. Sir Thomas Tresham, for example, took the considerable risk of converting to Catholicism in 1580, after which he suffered recurrent phases of persecution. He built a triangular lodge on his estate at Rushton in Northamptonshire, designed as a three-dimensional tribute to the Holy Trinity. Each of its three sides has three roof gables and three decorative motifs on each of three levels. Triangular buildings are, of course, impractical to live in and don't contain much space, but he was making his point in the boldest possible way. The poet Henry Oxenden built a round lodge on a hilltop in 1631 and explained his reasoning in a poem. "Tell me, Henry, tell me how, Henry, in thy mind it came, upon the hill thy house so round to frame. I imitated the great architector, lo, both earth and heaven he hath framed so." Unfortunately, that house no longer exists. A smaller-scale Tudor house is Solgrave Manor in Northamptonshire, which has a special significance for American visitors. The land, part of a monastic estate, was bought in 1539 by Lawrence Washington, formerly mayor of Northampton. He was a well-to-do wool merchant, and over the next 20 years, he built his home there, finishing it off with the coat of arms of Queen Elizabeth I over the main doorway. The house stayed in his family for the next century until, in 1656, John Washington emigrated to the colony of Virginia, after which his English relatives sold the house. This John, the emigrant, was the great-grandfather of George Washington, planter, soldier, revolutionary, and first president of the United States. The house, which is far more modest than Hardwick, Woolerton, or Melford, but comfortable and distinguished, was bought in 1914 by a consortium of British and American antiquarians, in celebration of the fact that for the preceding 100 years, Britain and the United States had never gone to war. The Stars and Stripes, as well as the Union Jack, fly in the garden, and there's a stern bust of George himself in the front yard. Volunteers in period costume strive to recreate the 16th century mood of the house when it was new. When Elizabeth I died in 1603, the Tudor dynasty came to an end. King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England. After centuries of border warfare, the kingdoms were finally linked by a common ruler, although another 104 years would pass before they were politically integrated. James, nicknamed the wisest fool in Christendom, was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. She had died a martyr to the Catholic faith, which led England's Catholic minority to hope that he would look favourably on their plight and begin to roll back the Reformation. But James was a Protestant and understood the folly of repeating Queen Mary's mistakes. When the English Catholics realised that the king was not going to help them, some of them decided to assassinate him, along with the leading men of the kingdom, by blowing up the Houses of Parliament when the king was present for the state opening. This was in 1605. Guy Fawkes led the conspirators, who began to cram barrels of gunpowder into a small storeroom underneath the House of Lords. The plot was discovered on November the 5th. The villains were arrested before they could carry out the plot. Fawkes and his friends suffered the horrifyingly cruel execution that befell all traitors in that barbarous era. They were hanged, drawn, and quartered. Ever since then, November the 5th has been England's National Fireworks Day. When I was a child, it was still common to uphold the tradition of making a human dummy from old clothes stuffed with straw or newspaper, and to roll it around the streets in a baby stroller, calling out, "Penny for the guy!" Passers-by gave us coins to use in buying fireworks. By that time, the anti-Catholic nature of the celebration had largely disappeared. English Catholic kids enjoyed the fireworks just as much as the Anglicans. Incidentally, I was surprised on coming to live in America to discover that July the 4th is the comparable day here. The problem with July the 4th is that it doesn't get dark until late, so the poor children have to wait and wait for the light to fade. England in November, on the other hand, is completely dark by 5 p.m., so the festivities don't have to wait. On the other hand, rain often gets in the way, forcing a postponement, and it's nearly always bitterly cold. In this lecture, we've visited several sites that illustrate the transition out of the Wars of the Roses and into an era of relative political stability, which made a new style of building possible and prompted competition and ostentation. The 17th century bore witness to a conflict between the monarchy and parliament, which eventually led to 4 years of civil war. The historical sites associated with that political crisis and its resolution will be the topic of the next lecture.
Lecture 8, Magna Carta and Civil War.
Winston Churchill once said that democracy is the worst political system, except for all the others. It's often undignified, often leads to slanging matches among candidates, has a long history of pettiness and corruption, and brings out the worst qualities in many politicians. Nevertheless, we cherish it, or we ought to. A glance at the dictatorships still thriving in the world around us, and a glance at the tyrannies that have dominated the world through most of its history, should make us very glad to live where and when we do. Britain is no exception. Its kings may seem colourful and fascinating from a safe distance, but at first hand they could be terrifying, arbitrary and capricious. One of the inspiring aspects of British history is the way its kings were gradually forced to share power, to accept the rule of law, and eventually to submit to parliamentary domination. Today, Britain is a constitutional monarchy, in which the monarch has a few residual shreds of influence, but is now comfortably constrained by representative institutions, and survives only with their approval. Kings rarely gave up their powers without a fight. Not only can we trace the history of these fights, we can visit many of the places in which they happened. In England, the place to start is Runnymede, where, in 1215, King John signed Magna Carta. It's a broad, open meadow in the valley of the River Thames, not far from Heathrow Airport, and delightfully rural in view of its proximity to millions of people. If you're politically minded, it's the ideal first thing to see in Britain after you get off the plane, only about 20 minutes' drive from the airport. It was already historically significant by King John's time, being the place where the Anglo-Saxon kings had sometimes met their witan, or council of advisers. The meadow was donated to the nation in 1929 by Cara Rogers Broughton, a wealthy American's daughter who'd married a British engineer and knew about the area's history. The architect Edwin Lutyens built a pair of memorials and two lodges in their honour where you can park to begin your visit. A footpath takes you across the meadow, first of all to the Jurors, a 2015 bronze sculpture in the form of 12 chairs made by the English sculptor Hugh Locke. Collectively, they represent the 12 chairs occupied by members of a jury, and they celebrate the principle of habeas corpus and the right to a trial by a jury of one's peers. Each one is illustrated by a scene or symbol of this process, as, for example, the scales of justice or the imprisonment of Nelson Mandela in South Africa. Further along the path and through a gateway, you'll come to a small limestone rotunda at the edge of the valley, with eight columns. This is the Magna Carta Memorial, placed there by the American Bar Association in 1957, when it held its annual conference nearby. Its leaders were surprised to discover that the British themselves had left no marker. A standing granite pillar inside the rotunda carries the message, "To commemorate Magna Carta, symbol of freedom under law." The American lawyers returned to the site on several subsequent visits, including 2015, the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. Leaving the meadow and climbing a wooded hillside path, you come to a grove where a great carved marker stone carries this message. "This acre of English ground was given to the United States of America by the people of Britain in memory of John F. Kennedy." The dates of Kennedy's life are given, and then a passage from his inaugural address, declaring the intention to pay any price, bear any burden, in order to assure the survival and success of liberty. The memorial's designer, Geoffrey Jellicoe, said he was inspired by Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan's allegory of Christian life as a journey through hardship and temptation. The 50 steps that lead up to the memorial stone correspond to the 50 states of the Union. Two terraces, each with a stone seat, give you the chance to catch your breath after the climb. The leaves of an oak tree planted behind the memorial turn bright red in November, the month of Kennedy's assassination. The Queen, opening the memorial in 1965, in the presence of Jackie Kennedy and her two young children, noted that Magna Carta was "a part of the heritage which the people of the United States of America share with us," and that it was therefore altogether fitting that Runnymede should be the site of Britain's memorial to the late president. You can watch the film of her speech online. There is a copy of the Magna Carta on display at the British Library, and one each at Salisbury and Lincoln Cathedrals. It was written as an attempt to mediate between King John and his rebellious barons, affording various legal rights and protections to them. It certainly didn't hold out much to the common people, and was quickly repudiated by King John, then annulled by the Pope. When subsequent kings wanted to raise revenue, they sometimes reissued milder versions of it to mollify their subjects. In the early 1600s, however, when James I and Charles I came into conflict with Parliament over where ultimate sovereignty lay, the Magna Carta became an important precedent. Now let's move forward from the time of King John at Runnymede to the early 17th century, a time when a combination of religious and political disagreements created a crisis in Britain. The religious differences divided the Church of England between those who on the one hand emphasised its closeness to Catholicism in all but church governance, and those on the other who insisted that it was a thoroughly Protestant church that rejected all vestiges of the Catholic past. This latter party were named Puritans because they wanted to purify the church. As for politics, the main disagreement of the 1620s and 1630s hinged on whether the king enjoyed absolute power as God's agent on earth, or whether he was subject to the law and held sovereignty jointly with Parliament. In the decades after 1603, when James I came to the throne, he and his son Charles I called parliaments irregularly, usually because they needed to raise money for military expeditions. Parliament presented lists of grievances, saying it would grant money to the king once he had redressed them. He answered that they must first grant the money, and then he might give his attention to their petitions. A series of bitter standoffs finally led Charles I to attempt government without parliamentary help through most of the 1630s. It worked until a Scottish invasion of northern England forced his hand. Rather than admit the principle of Parliament's right to a permanent place in the Constitution, Charles raised an army and declared war against Parliament. It raised an army of its own and fought back. So much time has passed since the English Civil War that most of its battlefields are now indistinct, often indicated just by stone markers. The two decisive battles of the war took place at Marston Moor, Yorkshire, in 1644, and Naseby in Northamptonshire in 1645. Marston Moor was, in terms of numbers, the biggest battle ever fought in England. It was also the place where Prince Rupert, the king's dashing, hot-blooded young nephew, lost his reputation for invincibility as a cavalry commander. By contrast, the parliamentary cavalry leader, Oliver Cromwell, distinguished himself as a first-rate battlefield commander. Justifying his appointment of officers who did not come from the gentry class, he wrote, "If you choose godly, honest men to be captains of horse, honest men will follow them. I would rather have a plain, russet-coated captain who knows what he fights for and loves what he knows than that which you call a gentleman and is nothing else." Unfortunately, there's not a lot to see at Marston Moor except for a modest stone monument raised in 1939 by the Cromwell Association. At Naseby in 1645, Parliament's well-trained new model army, 22,000 strong, led by General Thomas Fairfax and Cromwell, routed a smaller royalist army, killed or captured most of the king's veteran officers, and ended his ability to field a viable force. A few months later, the war ended in victory for Parliament. The Naseby battlefield, like Marston Moor, now comprises several working farms, a stone marker, a battlefield trail, a series of elevated platforms, and several historical plaques explain the main events of the battle to visitors. But their presence is, at least for now, low-key. An organisation called the Naseby Battlefield Project is working hard to restore the site, to make the events of the battle more obvious and more vivid for visitors. Let's hope they succeed. The best way to get a feel for the English Civil War until the battlefields are improved is by watching reenactments by two groups of enthusiasts, the Sealed Knot Society and the English Civil War Society. They assemble at Marston Moor, Naseby and other sites such as Edge Hill in Warwickshire, usually on the anniversaries of the actual battles. They also replay several major castle sieges from the conflict. The Sealed Knot, founded in the late 1960s by a World War II veteran who'd written a book about Edge Hill, emphasises that it is a non-political organisation, is dedicated to education, research and enjoyment, not the glorification of war. Do you want to hear the roar of the cannon, the thunder of horses' hooves, see thousands of soldiers clashing in battle, watch the displays of battlefield standards, smell the smoke of the musketeers and hear the beating of the drums? Or do you even want to be a part of it? Thousands of enthusiasts have answered this call, and the reenactments, carefully staged to avoid deaths and mutilations, bring out rival armies in splendid period dress. Participation has taught the members and the broader community a great deal about 17th century weapons, dress, transportation, food and organisation. It is as valuable to the historical study of the Civil War as metal detectorists are to the recovery of Anglo-Saxon and Viking treasure hoards. When the Civil War ended, King and Parliament negotiated uneasily about the future balance of power. Charles I, however, took the view that he'd been appointed by God and that Parliament had no rights except through his grace. He was imprisoned at Carisbrook Castle on the Isle of Wight, a beautiful medieval castle that's now open to visitors. The bed he slept in is on display, and the politics of the 14 months he spent there lucidly explained. Although he was a prisoner, he still had a great deal of influence and latitude of action. He provoked a royalist revival, supported by a Scottish invasion into northern England. The new model army, outnumbered 2-1, but with Cromwell now in sole command, crushed this royalist revival at the Battle of Preston in the summer of 1648. It had shown itself to be a superb fighting organisation, well-disciplined, well-trained, and driven by a high sense of purpose. Many of its Puritan soldiers were politicised by the war and began to speak out on behalf of radical changes to England's government. In the autumn of 1647, a group called the Levellers published The Case of the Army Truly Stated, which led to a series of discussions on political first principles. These discussions, the Putney Debates, were held in the Church of St. Mary the Virgin in Putney, which you can still visit just south of the River Thames. Some of the soldiers spoke eloquently on behalf of a one-man, one-vote democracy, with the House of Commons supreme, annual parliaments, equal constituencies, freedom of speech, religion and the press, and no more censorship. The monarchy would be abolished. One soldier, Colonel Thomas Rainsborough, made the case for universal suffrage like this. "I think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live, as the greatest he. And therefore, truly, sir, I think it clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government. And I do think that the poorest man in England is not at all bound in a strict sense to that government that he have not had a voice to put himself under." Henry Ireton, Cromwell's son-in-law, a senior army officer, countered that only property owners should be permitted to vote because only they had a permanent stake in the nation. Cromwell, like Ireton, was sceptical about the Levellers, but he'd now lost all patience with the king and was determined to get rid of him once and for all. He and his supporters purged Parliament of moderates who still wanted a reformed monarchy. The remaining MPs, members of Parliament, in the so-called Rump Parliament, put the king on trial for treason. The trial was held in Westminster Hall. This magnificent medieval building is one of the few parts of Parliament to have survived down to the present. It was spared from the disastrous parliamentary fire of 1834 and from the Nazi Blitz of 1940. The beautiful hammer beam roof measures 70 by 240 feet, providing a huge interior space unobstructed by columns. This extraordinary roof has seen many spectacular moments over the last millennium, but probably none more dramatic than the trial of Charles I. He stuck to his original point that Parliament had no right to try him. "This day's proceeding cannot be warranted by God's laws, for, on the contrary, the authority of obedience unto kings is clearly warranted and strictly commanded in both the Old and New Testament. No learned lawyer will affirm that an impeachment can lie against the king. And one of their maxims is that the king can do no wrong." Unmoved, the Rump Parliament found Charles guilty and sentenced him to death. The sentence was carried out not at the usual execution site, the Tower of London, but in Whitehall, in front of the banqueting house, on a cold January day in 1649. The king wore two shirts to keep warm, from fear that onlookers might otherwise mistake his shivering for fear. Soldiers separated the crowd of onlookers from the scaffold. After the headsman had struck his blow, the crowd groaned. Many pushed forward to dip their handkerchiefs in the blood. The body, with the head crudely stitched back on, was buried at St. George's Chapel, Windsor Castle, adjacent to the bodies of King Henry VIII and his most beloved wife, Jane Seymour. This chapel is one of the highlights of Windsor. Besides being the burial site of several monarchs and the wedding site of several others, such as Edward VII, it's a fine example of late Gothic architecture from just before the Reformation. When the mangled body of King Charles I was laid to rest beneath its fan vaults, however, it was in poor repair after being vandalised and plundered by parliamentary soldiers. We see it today after extensive renovations in the late 1600s and again in the mid-1800s. The banqueting house, site of Charles's execution, is also worth a visit. Built by order of Charles's father, King James I, it's the handiwork of Inigo Jones, one of the great luminaries of 17th century English architecture. Jones was influenced by the Italian Renaissance and by the work of Michelangelo, which he'd studied on a series of three visits to Italy. Charles himself, in quieter times, had commissioned Peter Paul Rubens, the era's greatest Flemish artist, to paint a set of murals for the ceiling, the Union of the Crowns, the peaceful reign of James I, and the apotheosis of James I, which shows the old king being carried up to heaven. Ironically, these paintings must have been some of the last things Charles ever saw, because he spent the morning of his final day in the banqueting house in prayer and in saying farewell to his children, before being led out through a specially created doorway onto the scaffold. Located right in the heart of London, the banqueting house is a good place to meditate on the benefits of mixed government and political stability. The execution of Charles I made Oliver Cromwell the most important man in Britain, the leading regicide who had the confidence of the army and Parliament. He tried to maintain rule through the rump Parliament until 1653, with it acting as legislature and executive. This was the English Commonwealth. Then, impatient at the Commonwealth's inability to get things done, he abolished it, had himself declared the Lord Protector of England, and ruled as a military dictator until his death in 1658. He's one of the most controversial people in British history, a tyrant in the eyes of royalists and Roman Catholics, but a hero of democracy and liberty to republicans and nonconformists. The complicated political circumstances of the 1640s and 50s provide evidence in support of and against both views. Cromwell had been born in 1599 in Huntingdon, East Anglia, to a family of prosperous gentlemen. He studied at the local grammar school, then went to Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge. He married the daughter of a wealthy London merchant, went through a religious conversion to become a committed Puritan, and lived in a fine timbered house in the town of Ely, which is open to visitors. Rooms in the house recreate 17th century domestic life, and there's an informative exhibition on the Civil War and Cromwell's rise to power. The house also features an allegedly haunted bedroom. Details of his early life are scanty. Cromwell might have studied law as a young man, and it's possible that he fought on the Protestant side in the 30 Years' War, which would explain his military ability. A member of Parliament, as the crisis of the early 1640s developed, he distinguished himself as an outstanding cavalry leader, then as a hard negotiator, willing to take the drastic step of sweeping away the monarchy. In 1657, Parliament offered him the crown. He could have become King Oliver I, but he was determined to avoid it. The most famous employee of Cromwell's government was the poet John Milton. Son of a well-to-do London family, Milton had studied at Cambridge and made the grand tour of Europe. During the Civil War, he'd written the Areopagitica, an attack on censorship. A phenomenal polymath, he was the Commonwealth's foreign language specialist, the Secretary for Foreign Tongues, who drafted Latin letters to other governments and maintained diplomatic correspondence with governments in France, Spain, Italy, and the Netherlands. He wrote a defense of the regicide and a sonnet in praise of Cromwell as a man of both peace and war. Here's how it begins, and Darwin is a reference to one of Cromwell's battle honors. Cromwell, our chief of men, who through a cloud, not of war only, but detractions rude, guided by faith and matchless fortitude, to peace and truth thy glorious way has ploughed, and on the neck of crowned fortune proud, has reared God's trophies and his work pursued, while Darwin's stream with blood of Scots imbrued. By the end of the 1650s, Milton had gone blind, but continued to work by dictation to his long-suffering daughter. He finished Paradise Lost in 1665 at a cottage in Chalfont St. Giles, Buckinghamshire, where he'd taken his family to avoid the great plague that was devastating London. The cottage, his only surviving residence, is a small but lovely visit for anyone interested in writers' lives and homes. Operated as a museum, the cottage includes a collection of early editions of Milton's work, not only his poetry, but also his numerous prose writings, defending political and religious freedom. There's also a statue of Milton inside the London church where he is buried, St. Giles, Cripplegate. After Cromwell's death, it was clear that no one else enjoyed the confidence of both the army and Parliament, as he had done. His son Richard Cromwell ruled as Lord Protector for less than a year. Then, for the sake of political stability, Parliament decided to invite the old king's son to return from exile in France. He did so, being crowned King Charles II in 1660. Charles II never forgot what had happened to his father. Frequently at odds with Parliament, he was nevertheless careful not to antagonise it to the breaking point. By comparison with Cromwell, he was easygoing. He reopened the theatres and authorised the celebration of Christmas once more. Theatres and Christmas revels had been banned during the Commonwealth and Protectorate. Portraits from the time confirm the contrast. They show Charles in magnificent clothes and wigs, while Cromwell and his men are depicted in pared-down blacks and browns. Charles II's successor, his brother James II, was hopelessly inept when it came to politics. He'd become a Catholic during his long exile in France, which made him anathema to most Englishmen. Even so, he could have survived had he not antagonised all the influential groups whose help he needed. After less than 4 years on the throne, he was forced to flee in 1688. Parliament then invited William of Orange, the stadtholder of the Netherlands, who was married to James's Protestant daughter, Mary, to become king instead. They were equal monarchs, William III and Mary II. This sequence of events, in effect a bloodless coup, is remembered as the Glorious Revolution, important in British history and a source of inspiration to the American revolutionaries of the 1770s and 1780s. From then on, the two unarguable points in English political life were, first, that the monarch must be a Protestant, and second, that the monarch could not reign without the support of Parliament. Never again has Britain confronted regime change as it did twice in the 17th century. Instead, a gradual process of political evolution substituted for the revolutions that have been so common in the rest of the world. Although William was a tireless soldier, scourge of Louis XIV, he suffered from asthma and found life at Whitehall Palace unendurable because of the area's foggy humidity close to the evil-smelling River Thames. Instead, he and Mary bought a big house at the western end of Hyde Park, a mile back from the river, on higher ground. They hired the age's leading architect, Christopher Wren, to extend it and renamed it Kensington Palace. It's been a royal residence ever since and is an outstanding example of late 17th and early 18th century design and decoration, with many of its showrooms now open to the public. It was one of the homes of Princess Diana, the first wife of Prince Charles. When she was killed in a Paris car crash in 1997, mourners left more than 1 million bouquets of flowers outside its gates. The turbulence of the 17th century threw up many radical political groups like the Levellers. It also generated new religious groups, of which the most enduring was the Quakers. George Fox, a shepherd and wool trader from Leicestershire, began the group in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. The intensity of his preaching convinced influential people to follow him, some from the higher reaches of society. His group, the Society of Friends, did not believe in original sin, were absolute pacifists, never swore oaths, never differentiated by social rank, accepted no rituals or hierarchies in their religion, and treated one another as brothers and sisters. These were revolutionary concepts for the era. When a Derby judge sentenced him to prison for blasphemy, Fox told him to tremble at the word of the Lord. The judge sneered that men who trembled were Quakers. The insult stuck and was taken up as a badge of honour. Quaker meeting houses were designed to make a sharp contrast with churches. Often square, unadorned, without altars or iconography, they were the embodiment of the society's commitment to fraternity and equality. One of the best and oldest examples is Brigg Flats in Cumbria, on the eastern edge of the Lake District, still in use but also open to visitors. Its plain wooden benches form a square, Members often sit in silence for the hour of their meeting, or utter simple prayers without any liturgy, preaching, or hierarchy. The most famous English Quaker of the era, after Fox himself, was William Penn. Ironically, he was the son of a warrior, William Penn Sr. being an admiral, first for Cromwell and then for the restored Charles II. It would be hard to exaggerate the father's horror at his son's decision to